and welcome to Around and About Chattanooga. I'm your host, Michael Edward Miller. On today's program, I've got an in-depth interview with Southern humorist Roy Blunt Jr. If you're a regular NPR listener, you probably recognize him as a panelist on the weekly radio quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. That's where Blunt and other contestants answer irreverent questions about the news.
Police who searched Florida woman Rebecca Tracked Cater's car this week found her marijuana stash easily because it was hidden in a blank.
Hidden in her driver's license
thing. It was hidden in a box labeled Rebecca's Pot.
Oh.
First Lady Michelle Obama donated her inaugural ball gown to the blank.
To the Mardi Gras parade.
No.
You may also know Roy Blunt Jr. is an author. It's impressive just how many books he's written and how many subjects he's written about. He wrote a book on cats, plus one on dogs. He's also put together an anthology of Southern humor. He's written about New Orleans. He's written a biography of Robert E. Lee, a memoir. He's written about sports, so many different subjects. One thing about Roy Blunt Jr. is puzzling, though. He's a celebrated Southern author. He grew up in Decatur, Georgia, but he lives in New England. And so that's one of the first things that we talked about. Here's my interview with Roy Blunt Jr. Welcome to Around and About Chattanooga.
Thank you, Mike. Good to be here.
You're an author, a humorist, panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, former president of the Authors Guild, a member of the Fellowship of Southern Authors, and you moved to Massachusetts on purpose. First of all, tell me, I know you've written more than 20 books. How many books exactly have you written?
23.
Yep. I'm assuming you moved up north on purpose, or were you exiled there? Why would a Southern writer?
It was a hurricane. It was a tornado. I never did figure out what kind of wind it was. It just deposited to me down there, and it took me 2-3 years to realize I was in the north. No, well, it was on purpose, but, you know, I went up to, many, many years ago, I went up to New York City to write for Sports Illustrated, and then I got divorced, and my ex-wife moved to Western Massachusetts with the children, so I moved up there to have joint custody and to freelance, and I've been there pretty much ever since, but I get around a lot, get back down south a lot. I just got back from 2 months in New Orleans, which I've always loved.
And you've actually written a book about New Orleans.
I wrote a little book about New Orleans that came out just before Katrina, yeah, called Feet on the Street, Rambles Around New Orleans. The history is so thick around here, you could pop it open with an oyster knife. And oh, the aromarama. Fresh ground coffee, spilt beer, hot pastry, sloshed Tabasco, yesterday's fish, patchouli oil, and hints of some fortuitous compound. Mule plop and olive salad. We were down in New Orleans and had Canadian friends visiting us, and we're sitting around talking about politics, and one of our Canadian friends suddenly said, "Where are all the rednecks?" You know, as if we were hiding all the rednecks from her. And I said, well, you know, New Orleans is not exactly, I mean, New Orleans is a little different from other parts of the South. No. I mean, as if I was trying to say that New Orleans was somehow innocent of racism or something. I wasn't saying that at all. I was just saying it's different from Birmingham or Memphis or Chattanooga. But I think people have this notion that, you know, that there's this sort of simple form of being Southern, and they don't like it.
As a Southerner living in the North, is that a big source of humor for you, the culture clash?
Yeah, I wrote a book called, I can't remember what my books
Dispatches
are called.
Why from
should
up
I
south?
Remember what my books are called? Yeah, it's called, what's this main title, though? It's called Dispatches from Up South.
Long Time Leaving.
Long Time Leaving, yeah, long time. Been a long time leaving my mind. But, yeah, Long Time Leaving. And that was a collection of essays that I'd written for Oxford American and New York Times and all sorts of different people talking about. And also I wrote a book about crackers back during the Carter administration that dwelled upon the strangeness of being a Southerner in the North and the and resisting the perceptions, the stereotypes that people in the North have about Southerners, and also sort of enjoying some of the stereotypes that people have about Southerners.
On the subject of Southern humor, There's something that you wrote in your book, Long Time Leaving, just an excerpt of that. I was wondering if you could just read that excerpt.
Okay. Southern humor tends to be mixed in with violence, heartbreak, preachment, politics, libidinousness. That's a hard word to pronounce. Libidinousness, that is to say, having to do with the libido, gustation, anger, nostalgia, racial conflict, and adventure. In the South, humor, like argumentativeness in New York, is not so much a specialization as a requisite element in discourse. And Southern humor tends to work best when it isn't trying to be any funnier than life and death.
What do you mean by that exactly, when it's not trying to be funnier than life and death?
Well, I don't know. I worked hard to put it that way. I think Southern humor deals... Northern humor, the old New Yorker tradition of American humor tended to be about, sort of neurotic complaints. But Southern humor deals with slavery and war and blood and hatred. And that makes it a lot more interesting, I think. A lot trickier, and there's some terrible Southern humor, but there's also some... I edited an anthology of Southern humor.
Yes, you did. And one thing I think is really interesting that you did in that anthology, you included Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah.
Why would you include Edgar Allan Poe in a book of Southern humor?
Well, he was a Virginian, and he lived in Baltimore, too, but he was certainly spent a lot of time in Virginia, and he thought of himself as Southern, and he wrote some certainly things that were meant to be humorous, and in fact, some of them still are. So there was it's impossible to describe the essay that I included, but it's called X-ing a Paragob Grab or
yeah.
something like that. And it relies heavily on typographical errors, but it's pretty funny. So I put it in there.
Did you get any flack from editors or other writers, anybody saying, you can't include Edgar Allan Poe in a book of Southern humor?
No.
Really?
I wasn't trying to be obvious. I was trying to surprise people with what I could dig up. And I think people were, why are you so appalled that I put Edgar Allan Poe in my book of Southern humor?
Interested
I
because...
I had Flannery O'Connor in there. The thing about Southern writers tend to have written something funny, which is not always true of great Northern writers. But great Southern, Faulkner wrote funny stuff and Flannery O'Connor wrote funny stuff. Louis Armstrong wrote a really funny autobiography. Tennessee Williams was funny. All the best Southern writers have been funny on the page, which is not true of Theodore Dreiser or, I don't know. So I think there is something that Southerners tend to be, if Southerners have enough sense to be to write, they have enough sense to be funny.
You also, I think you've included Hunter S. Thompson in Southern
writers.
Yeah,
he's from Louisville, and he certainly thought of himself as Southern, talked about himself as being Southern, and I thought he was funny. Not always, but he wrote some funny stuff.
Would you consider Stephen Colbert to be a Southern humorist?
That's an interesting question. He is, of course, from South Carolina. Humorists tend to be writers, and I've never read anything that he wrote that was...
True.
He's an extraordinary TV comedian, and I was on a panel... In fact, I was on a panel with him talking about humor a few years ago, and he said that he had purposely lost his Southern accent because it made him sound dumb.
Huh.
And I said, well, is that a problem? Would that have been a problem in your work? But because it seemed to me, he sounds pretty dumb as it is. on purpose. I don't think of him as a writer. I guess I haven't really looked at his books. It'd be interesting to do that. I wonder if his books aren't written by his writers.
Oh, yeah, that's a good question
so
right
that
there.
That interferes with your status as a humorist.
Yeah. If you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Roy Blunt, Jr., he writes all kinds of books on different topics like Southern humor, cats and dogs, sports. Two of his latest books are about language itself. Alphabet Juice is one of them. It's partly a comedic dictionary. It's partly just a celebration of language itself. It explores the origin of words and the ways that they're used. Here's an excerpt from the audiobook.
Jerry Clower once said that the football coach at Mississippi State was making progress on keeping his players in school. He got those boys making straight A's. Some of their B's are still a little crooked, but A stands for answer, across in crossword puzzles, adultery, highest grade. No, I don't mean the highest grade of adultery, but I'll say this. In my experience, the highest grade of adultery in the movies, I don't recommend it elsewhere, involves Diane Lane. In Lane, the A is long, open-mouthed, with a touch of consonantal Y at the end. Lane. Not to say there's a universal value in that sound, but in English people do like to holler, yay, hooray, hey, okay, anchors away, USA, in better times, and up, up and away. In Lewis Carroll's Jabberwocky, what did someone chortle in his joy? Kaloo, Calais. Inspired nonsense gets down into a language's jelly. Donkeys bray, hounds bay, boys stray. But denotative upbeat long A words include may, lay, play, gravy.
Your last two books have been kind of about language itself.
Well, yeah. I'm not sure. Yeah, I guess they were the last two. Alphabet Juice and Alphabetter Juice, which I'd always wanted to write a book about words and letters and the sounds of words. And I read in a linguistics textbook that the relation between words and their meaning, words themselves, the sounds and letters of words, and their meanings is arbitrary. And I hate for young people to be taught nonsense like that. Because I think lots of words are, the meaning is reinforced at least if it does not spring from the sound of the word. Words like wheedle and, if the sounds of words were arbitrary, then splurge could mean scrimp and scrimp could mean splurge. Scrimp is a tight little word and splurge sort of throws itself out there. Just one example of me.
Well, as a humorist, how important is it that the sound of the word versus the meaning? Because I know in poetry, a lot of times you can get away with using words that don't really mean what they should mean in that particular sentence, but it's poetic, it's figurative, it's for the sound of it.
Well, I think poetry is the most precise form of writing, so I wouldn't say you can get away. You can get away with stuff that's better than prose, but you can't get away with stuff that's just vaguer than prose. You're trying to go for some... poetry generally tries to capture the magic and the sub-dictionary sort of associations involved in words. And so the sound of words obviously is very important in poetry. It's also very important in advertising.
Do you ever actually make up words?
Yeah. The word antepenultimatum. I made up.
Oh, wow.
People think that penultimate means the absolutely last most, but it doesn't. It means next to the last.
Right.
And antepenultimate means just before, the next to the next to the last. So an antepenultimatum is when your mother calls you to come into the house, but you know she's going to call you twice more before you really have to come in.
I've got a few words that were generated by my phone because... That's the era we live in now, where you can buy an app for your phone that randomly generates words that never existed before.
Really?
Yes. I was wondering if you could maybe come up with some definitions for the words.
Okay. I'll try.
Bear booze.
Bear booze. Well, that's, of course, when if you've ever watched Bears play football, you've also watched the Bears on... rooting for different teams, and they're bear yays and bear boos. I mean, a bear boo goes sort of like, it's kind of low down boos. Not boo, that's not a bear boo. That's more of a bird boo. But bears boo in a kind of gruff sort of way, and they cheer. It's hard to tell the difference between a bear boo and a bear cheer, actually. Bear yay.
Valthrog.
Valthrog? Well, it's V-A-W-T-H-R-O-G doesn't seem to derive from any kind of roots that I can figure out. But and it doesn't seem to be a corporate name. You wouldn't say I'm over in personnel at Valthrog. because people would shrink away from you. You know, you kind of think maybe it has something to do with a frog, but I don't know. I mean, it's not V. If it was V-O-W, throg, then it would sound like a promise made by a throng that has a cold.
How about a pouch ping?
Pouch ping. Well, that sounds like when your phone goes off in your pocket.
You're listening to Around It About Chattanooga. Stay tuned. More of my interview with Roy Blunt Jr. is coming up in just a moment.
Funding comes from Tennessee Reproductive Medicine, specialists in IVF and infertility treatments, dedicated to building families, online at trmbaby.com.
Support comes from Cumberland Trust, providing trust administration designed for blended families. Details at cumberlandtrust.com.
You're listening to Around It About. Just a quick note before we get back to the interview with Roy Blunt Jr. This segment was originally recorded in April during the Celebration of Southern Literature. While Roy Blunt Jr. was at the celebration, he took part in this panel called What is Southern These Days? So in the final part of the interview, I'm going to talk to him about that topic. As part of the conference that you're participating here, the Celebration of Southern Literature, you're going to take part in a panel discussion called What is Southern These Days? Why do you think that would even be a question? Why would there be any kind of controversy or dispute over what is and is not Southern?
All you have to do is just say grits, I guess, and then ask for questions. I think it's always been, I don't know, I mean, people are always saying, well, there's no such thing as Southern anymore, that, you know, the country is all just the same, and to me, that is obviously not true. I mean, I was in Massachusetts a couple of days ago, and I'm in Tennessee now, and I can tell the difference.
How can you tell the difference?
Well, people, there's still some people with Southern accents, though fewer and fewer, I would say. I only got here last night, but last night I was with a lot of Southern writers, so probably because they were here for the conference, and we were talking about mules, in fact. We were talking about mules. I haven't talked about mules in Massachusetts. I doubt I've ever talked about mules in Massachusetts. but in Tennessee, even if it hadn't just been a bunch of Southern writers, I think you're more. Have you been talking about mules at all today?
Actually, we were yesterday.
There you go.
We really were.
There you go. Southern. It's not as though there are no farm animals in Massachusetts, but in the South, people. And Southern humor often involves animals and animal noises, and which gets back to language and the sounds of words. People try to capture the way animals sound in Southern humor more likely than in a New Yorker humor piece.
Who are some of your favorite Southern humorists besides yourself?
Well, Southern writers, Flannery O'Connor, you wouldn't call her. That's the thing about Southern humor. It's not all written by humorists. It's written by Flannery O'Connor, who's one of my favorite writers. I'm trying to remember whom I included in my book. There are a lot of, it's been a while since I put that book together. But Faulkner can be very funny, and Louis Armstrong wrote a memoir in which he talked about eating and how he tried to, he was on a long trip and he tried to save money by not eating much. And he was with a friend of his who in the band who was also not eating much and who just about starved himself to death to the point where he actually killed himself. And Armstrong's conclusion was that he said, I may never be rich, but I will be a fat man. You can always, that's not a very contemporary sentiment, but it sort of appeals to me.
I know you've got a website. What is your website?
Just where I tell people if they want to know my biography. If I'm going to go show up somewhere, they go to my website, and I don't keep it up very much. I'm not a social network person. I don't do Facebook or Twitter or any of those things. Maybe I should, but I'm old and cranky, and I don't do it yet. The whole notion of tweeting just sounds ridiculous to me. Writers shouldn't tweet. Writers should speak in a much deeper and more complicated voice than that. Maybe making Valthrogs.
I think you've made a pretty good career of doing that.
Well, still got to keep doing it, though, so I don't know. I may have to sort of break down and tweet. I don't know, just in order so people will let me keep on writing.
Well, Roy Blunt, Jr., thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mike. Good to be here.
Funding comes from Arts Build and their 7-in-7 campaign to strengthen Chattanooga through arts and culture. More information about the 7-in-7 campaign at artsbuild.com. Thanks to Arts Build, the arts build us.
And that's it for our show today. Thank you all for listening. If you have questions, comments, or story ideas, you can email me, mike-miller@utc.edu. Again, mike-miller@utc.edu.
Around and About Chattanooga is a production of WUTC with contributions by the staff and volunteers of WUTC. Find us online at wutc.org.